Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. I'm Tom Schumann, Vice President of Communications with the Indiana Chamber. Our guest today is Kevin Chavis, who recently gave an inspiring presentation to the Economic Club of Indiana audience. We were unable to record that presentation, so we're going to take the opportunity today to chat with Kevin, gather more of his insights into today's topic of education reform. Kevin is an Indiana native and a national advocate for education reform who's now based in Washington, D.C. A Brebeuf Jesuit and Wabash College graduate, he's on a mission to provide each and every child equal access to a high-quality education. Kevin, I'd like to start with the Indiana part of that introduction. Both the formal education you received at Brebeuf and Wabash College, as well as your experiences growing up in Indiana. Talk about how that helped prepare you and influence your views on education.
Well, yeah, Tom, I tell you, I was really fortunate. I had a terrific educational experience. But frankly, it began at home. I mean, my father was the first in his family to go to college. He grew up on a farm in Aiken, South Carolina. He met my mother, who had attended Butler University. And then my father was one of the first African Americans to graduate from Butler Pharmacy School. My parents met while he was stationed here in the Army. He left the Army and went to pharmacy school. And my father and both my parents had a put a premium on education. And it wasn't until I got out of college and out of law school where I realized that, you know, a lot of families, a lot of kids don't have that benefit where there's such a premium placed on education. And as I started to, you know, get involved in public service and visit schools, I was just amazed and frankly mortified by the lack of emphasis placed on just basic education and the need to be fully educated to be a productive member of society. So, you know, I think my Indiana experience, I was really, really fortunate. I mean, I grew up in Butler Tarkington neighborhood. It was an integrated neighborhood even back in the 70s, and went to great schools and had the fruits of that that, you know, laid out before me, unlike many others in other parts of the country. So I'm now, as you mentioned, on a mission to make sure that others get that same benefit that I had.
Kevin, on a less positive note, I've heard you now several times refer back to your hometown as an example of one of the places that with a graduation rate that just doesn't match up. Can you share with our listeners some of those numbers, if you would, and the reactions that you would expect that to generate from people?
Well, you know, Tom, I'm appalled by Indiana with all of its assets, with, you know, that Midwest stability at the centerpiece of family life. I'm appalled at how we've let public education slide. In the most recent SHOP report statistics, is 80% of the African American boys that enter high school drop out in Indianapolis, and those that enter IPS. Only Detroit has a larger number. The other thing that I found out that similarly, the white boys who enter IPS, they drop out at high percentages. So it's clear that there's something wrong with traditional public education in our state that isn't working. And you know, you've heard me speak. I'm equally appalled by the fact that people aren't outraged by that. I mean, I think that's the type of thing that should lead all of us to want to run to the streets and just, you know, storm the gates. It doesn't make sense. And if this country's going to work, if Indiana's going to work, we need to be clearly, you know, more focused on channeling this outrage into change. I do have high hopes for Tony Bennett. You know, I think he gets it, but he's going to need help. And I think the citizens need to be more engaged and involved in this.
Kevin, in your presentation to the Economic Club, you gave several other reasons for people to be outraged outraged, reasons that are tied to public safety, to jobs, to the economy. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, I like to tell people that, you know, initially, you know, there's a moral obligation. You know, similar to the experience that I had growing up, that there's a moral obligation to make sure that other children get the same educational opportunity. But, you know, then I jokingly say that, well, some people may not respond to the moral imperative to act. The right thing to do may not be good enough. That being the case, then I talk about public safety, that the National Bureau of Economic Research says that if we increase the graduation, high school graduation rates in this country by 10%, there will instantly be a 20% decrease in the national murder rates. And so for those to whom morality, you know, doesn't work, I then say that maybe public safety does. But, you know, for some people that may be not be enough, and I thought it was really fitting to focus with my economic club address on the economic impact of the achievement gap. And the McKinsey report that came out last year, the first of its kind, measured the economic impact of the achievement gap on all levels in our country. Now, the achievement gap not only relates to the gap between the learning of black kids and white kids, it also relates to the gap in learning between low-income kids of all colors and races and kids of means, and then the gap between all American school-aged children and compared to those other industrialized countries around the world. And the gap is growing, and if we had closed the gap in all three areas, if we had started in 1998 and by 2008, if we had closed the gap, you're talking about trillions of dollars saved in the gross domestic product. And the failure of us to close those achievement gaps in education has created a permanent national recession larger than the one we're experiencing. So, you know, the point I'm trying to make to people is that, you know, the economic solvency of this country is largely dependent on us getting education right for all children. And not only is that gap really intense among children of color and white kids, but, you know, the McKinsey report bears out the fact that, you know, even if we take our best students here in this country in public schools, you know, they're sliding behind the best students around the world because they are more open to innovation, to choice options, and to doing things creatively as opposed to this one-size-fits-all model that I think has put a stranglehold on our progress.
Kevin, here in Indiana, our organization and other advocates have spent an inordinate amount of time defeating legislation that would actually shorten the school day or the school year. You know, no one has said that parent-teacher conferences or teacher development opportunities are not important, but when they actually shorten the student instructional time, that's where we have to step in. Give your take, your analysis on not just in Indiana, but in America, the length of the school day and year and how it compares to other places around the world.
Well, you know, there's a great book by Malcolm Gladwell which talks about outliers, and he lays out that the best and the brightest in all walks of life. He talks about, you know, Michael Jordan. He talks about the Beatles. That if you look at the time spent on tasks, that part of the reason why these best and the brightest in their chosen field of human endeavor were so good is not only they had talent, but they had time. They spent time, and he talks about, you know, 10,000 hours or something like that. And then he talks about in education that in our country, we don't spend the time that we should with our kids doing math, doing basic education, compared to other countries around the world that are spending more time on those subjects. And, you know, to me, there's no doubt about it, particularly with the fact that some of our kids come into school a little bit behind, and then that's exacerbated when they don't get the instruction that they should at an early age. We need to emphasize more time on task, and that's why, you know, some of the great KIPP programs and charter schools around the country, you know, some of these great magnet school programs, they spend more time educating these kids. And, you know, to me, the union rules that suggest a teacher has to shut down at a certain time, that's disastrous to kids' interests. I mean, we need to spend more time educating these kids, particularly kids who have deficits, because the more time, the more likelihood you can close the gaps. The less time, then the less likelihood you close the gaps. It really is simple, and it's empirically proven. So, you know, I think that when you look at the work rules in the state of Indiana where they try to restrict the amount of time the teachers spend with students, I think it's counterproductive to kids' education.
Kevin, on a national level, you gave some examples, and I've read in other places, New York, California, your home area of Washington, in which those rules not just got in the way, but simply seemed absurd to furthering the education of our young people. Can you give some of those examples?
Yeah, I like to share these examples because the average public, they just don't know. You know, for instance, in New York, Joe Klein took me to the Rubber Room, and the Rubber Room is a building, a four-story building in Manhattan, where it's at any given time, hundreds of teachers check in at 9, they leave at 3, and the reason why they come to the Rubber Room is they are deemed to be unfit to be around children. Some have even been convicted of molesting children. But because of the union work rules, and even though New York is the most extreme and outrageous example, every jurisdiction school district has similar work rules. But because of the work rules, it takes years to sometimes get a bad teacher off the payroll. So some of these teachers have been coming to the Rubber Room for years. And recently, with all the budget crisis that New York has faced, you know, it was in the New York Times that they're spending $82 million paying teachers to go to the Rubber Room. So, you know, that's $82 million that could be used to educate kids, but you're paying teachers who everyone agrees shouldn't be around kids. In D.C., you know, we have, you know, the union was insistent on keeping a clause in that every teacher had to leave the premises by 3:15, and they were told that if they didn't, they would be shown out the door and the door would be locked behind them because of the work rules and the hours that put in teaching these kids. They didn't want teachers working after hours. For many of the young, energetic, cause-driven teachers, they wanted to work extra hours because they wanted to help these kids do homework that otherwise they knew they wouldn't get done. So that's another example. And then, you know, in California, Governor Schwarzenegger talked about the fact that, you know, that teachers in California under the work rules there get tenure for life after 2 years on the job. Just 2 years, and they don't have to have evaluation or performance reviews. They can't be fired. And even some of the union material suggests it takes 5 to 7 years to decide whether or not someone's a good teacher. But under the work rules in California, you get a job for life after 2 years. I mean, if you look at the work rules, I think it's much or more than anything, you know, that's been a big problem in terms of right-sizing education, because these work rules really aren't kid-friendly, and it's made a big difference in terms of, you know, putting those workers' benefits ahead of the interests of children.
Kevin, I mentioned in the lead-in to today's interview about your efforts in D.C. with the charter school legislation that passed, but then the efforts over a number of years to grow the charter schools to make a difference for so many students. Can you talk about that effort and some of the key points along the way to success there in Washington?
Well, I was fortunate. When I took over the chairmanship of the Education Committee in D.C. in 1997, we had just passed a charter bill, and we hadn't funded any of the schools yet, and the union told me, you know, in effect, they sat down with me and said, we're mad at you because you voted for the charter bill, but, you know, you can get back on our good side by not funding it. And I said, well, you know, let me learn more about it. And I talked to some of these folks who wanted to start charter schools, and they were talking about some innovative, creative ideas that, you know, there's no way the traditional system could have done, one of which was like the residential school. We had the first only public residential charter school in the country, 150 boys, 150 girls on a college-like campus. Some of these kids come from families that, you know, just don't serve them well, and they live there. And 95% of these kids go to college. And when they enter into seventh grade, it's from seventh to 12th grade, most of them are two or three grades behind, and they all end up now going to college. We got that school, the seed school, started. We had the hospitality school that Bill Marriott and members of the hotel and restaurant industry in D.C. came, and they wanted to get kids going in an innovative charter school where they could go into hotel and restaurant management or become chefs, work in the culinary arts, or go to college. That school is doing well. The Friendship Charter School, where it's the largest charter school in the country. It was founded by an African-American man, and they have, you know, college prep courses so that most of the kids who graduate have at least 5 to 10 college credits, and they're doing well. A whole host of these innovative charter schools have done well in D.C., largely because we just had an open environment, you know, when I was there as chairman of the Education Committee. And our new superintendent, Michelle Reed, is the first to say that because of our charter schools, it paved the way for innovation, so that now she's able to push for some of the reform measures that otherwise she couldn't push. And again, I think that speaks to this issue of competition. I know a lot of people don't want to hear the word competition, but any monopolistic approach is bad for, you know, the consumer. The breakup of AT&T led to the computer. It led to, you know, caller ID and call waiting and all these applications we now see on things like the iPhone. That would have never happened if there was still that monopolistic phone system. And I think we've seen the same thing in D.C. and other jurisdictions that have had charters, they've had tax credits, they've had scholarships or voucher programs, they've had virtual schools. I mean, we have a whole range of options for parents and families. It just grows the ability of innovation and creativity to flourish.
Kevin, as we look at the charter school landscape across the country, there's still certainly many creative examples, some that you mentioned, and others of innovative charter schools taking place. On the other hand, we hear of legislative and sometimes through the court system attempts to slow that progress. Give us kind of an overview of where you think that stands today.
Well, you know, I think that self-policing is the best way to go. I mean, when we started our charter movement in D.C. over 10 years ago, I was very clear, and I'm even more firm about this now, that to me the essence of the charter school concept is the contractual relationship. When you apply for your charter, you make certain promises about what you're going to do to benefit kids and their learning. And you have a contract, and you have goals and timetables, and the authorizer checks in on you every year. You have financial checks, you have governance checks, you have academic checks. And if you don't live under that contract right, then they'll put you on suspension or, you know, put some remediation in place. If you still don't live under it, you shut them down. And I think that bad charter schools should be shut down. And you don't need legislative action for that. To me, the key is to have a strong law that has that monitoring in place so that you don't let bad schools get open to begin with. If you put in a rigorous, you know, intense application process and you review it, and if they don't live up to it and you give them a chance to cure it and fix it and they don't, you shut them down. You know, I think that these legislative proposals to put moratoriums on charters, or to put caps on charters, or to limit charters' growth, they're usually just tools of members who have been, you know, coddled by the union, and the union doesn't want charters around at all. I mean, in D.C., in New York, in California, in Florida, in Pennsylvania, in some of these states, Michigan, where we've seen charter schools, great charter schools, do well, we still see legislative efforts to shut those schools down. It just doesn't make sense. And that's why we've got to make sure to distinguish between, you know, legitimate, you know, policy directives and just the politics of trying to protect the status quo. And we need to be honest about that. I mean, some people try to couch it in different ways, but, you know, I just tend to talk straight about it. You know, if a school is working for a kid, I don't care what kind of school it is, it should be open, it should be allowed to flourish. But we shouldn't just let some of these legislative proposals, you know, see the light of day that are clearly tools of the status quo to try to, you know, end the progress that we've had. So fortunately, I'm glad to see that, you know, our president and Secretary Duncan have, you know, laid down the gauntlet on charter schools and it's made for a different dynamic in some of these state legislatures in terms of lifting these caps and stopping these moratoriums because, you know, the charter schools and competition, you know, is important in terms of overall education reform.
Kevin, in the past, many of these education issues seem to fall along political party lines, but talk about why that doesn't have to be the case and why political labels really should not matter in the education of our students.
I talk about the depoliticization of education. This is one issue, an area where we should, you know, lay our partisanship off on the side, you know, because it is about the future of this country. It is about, you know, our democracy. And as I say in my speeches, Tom, you've heard me say this, that to me, you know, it is the most important thing. I mean, you know, Thomas Jefferson said that the only way democracy will work is through an educated population because it is a participatory government and you cannot have an ignorant population be a democratic, run a democratic government. So, you know, we really do need to make sure that our kids are educated, and it extends beyond all the partisanship that unfortunately people bring to bear on this issue. I think, you know, I'm a Democrat, and I think that for the Democratic Party, you know, the union issue is huge because, you know, the NEA and AFT, they've had a stranglehold. They're the largest political lobby in Washington, and they're sometimes the largest political lobby in the states, just like ISTA. And I think that they have major influence on urban Democrats. You know, I speak all over the country, you know, and every time I speak before groups of legislators, I've had, you know, individual lunches or breakfasts or receptions with maybe 10 to 15, you know, black caucus delegations from various states. And every time I speak, several of them come up to me privately and say, you know, we agree with you, but we just can't do it. We can't support this stuff because the union would kill us. And my view, again, is we've got to figure out a way to support those folks and to give them some backbone to do what they know is right for their people and their children. And look, I'm not saying that every union proposal is anti-kids. I just know that when it's clear that the work rules dominate over the interests of children, there's something wrong with it. And we need to put those labels aside and figure out a way to support those Democrats who have the gumption to stand up. And we're seeing that now. I mean, there's the group I'm chairman of the board of now, the Black Alliance for Educational Options. We sponsor a seminar with African-American elected officials from around the country. We started with 10 4 years ago. This past November in Atlanta, we had over 100 African-American elected state officials who support charters and choice and performance pay and those kinds of things that I think will help move the ball forward. And there's a movement growing largely because the traditional model still continues not to work for all kids. And so that's why I think that as long as we can provide support for those who have the courage to jump out there, then they won't be alone because the numbers are growing. We just can't sustain these deficits the way they've been growing in the past.
Kevin, on the charter school topic, to bring it back home to Indiana here, we have a unique situation in which the Indianapolis mayor has authorizing authority for charter schools. What's your awareness of the situation here in Indiana and how the charter school movement is developing here?
Well, I remember when Mayor Peterson approached me about that several years ago. I think it's great. I mean, I've tried to urge other mayors to take that on. I know the mayor of St. Louis wants to have chartering authority, and he's visited Indianapolis. I think it's great. I think the more solid authorizers, the better. What's really good, and I think Indiana should be proud of itself for its charter law. It's got one of the best charter laws in the country. And having the mayor as an authorizer, having Ball State as an authorizer, I mean, it's really, really good because you bring resources to help ensure that the application process is rigorous. And, you know, again, my view is the entry point is so important. And by having, you know, a solid, rigorous process so that you just don't allow anybody to open a school, then that means more than likely you're going to have success as they get going. And then when you have the mayor as an authorizer, you have the full weight of the city municipal government supporting the effort. And so that there's better coordination of services. It could be human services. It could be police and fire services. It could be social services. So, you know, there's more of a willingness to work with the schools as opposed to having the charter schools be out there off on the side by themselves. And my impression is that it's working very well, you know, and I think that Indiana should be applauded for having this innovative approach that other people around the country are looking at. And that's really, really a positive thing.
Kevin, you mentioned earlier that you like some of the things that Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Bennett is trying to do. I know, I think you maybe had the first opportunity to meet him a couple of weeks ago when you were here, but what are some of those things you've heard and seen, and why do you like some of the direction that he's going?
Well, you know, I heard good things about him. There's a buzz nationally about Tony Bennett. And when I was able to sit down with him, I can see why. I mean, first of all, this guy's all about the kids, and that sort of jumps out at you. He really, and even though you would naturally think that all superintendents are like that, frankly, all of them aren't. I mean, most of them get caught into the work rules and, you know, the staff considerations. But those that really are just driven by one thing, and that's the kids and their achievement, they tend to stand out, and Tony is like that. Secondly, I mean, you know, this guy, you know, I'm a former athlete. I mean, he has this sort of athlete jock mindset. You know, we're going to work through this thing. We're going to work hard, and, you know, we're not going to take any prisoners. And you really need that in that role. You can't be shy or hesitant about, you know, pushing for change. And then third, you know, he clearly has some courage. I mean, he wants to work with people from what I could tell, but he's not afraid to take on the status quo. And, you know, I do think that he is understands the dynamics of the workforce in education. So he may not be as strident as I am about some of this stuff. So he's willing to work with people and try to make sure that, you know, that he's protective of people's status as best they can. He can do that as long as it doesn't impact on what's in best interest of these kids. But he's on a mission. I mean, he's made it very clear that there's no reason for him to do that job, to be a caretaker, that if there isn't substantive change, then he shouldn't be there. And I tell you, I admire him for that. So, you know, I think that he can do great things, but he can't do it alone. I mean, one of the challenges we've seen with other innovative superintendents around the country is that they have this vision, but then they really don't get much support, and then the political support backs away, and they end up being pariahs, and they get sort of cast aside. And, you know, I think that he's really trying to make sure he builds this base of support around him, both internally and externally, so he can do the things he needs to do. And that's vitally important, because once the sharks circle around you, you know, you can be on an island real quickly, and it makes it tough to get the job done.
Well, Kevin, maybe there's some synergy in the athletic side here. You were a nationally recognized basketball player at Wabash, and Superintendent Bennett is a former high school basketball coach who, I believe, even served in the dual role of basketball coach and principal at one of the smaller schools where he served at here in Indiana.
Yeah, I know. We talked about that, and you know, he has that swagger about him that you only see in Indiana, those of us who've been involved in Indiana basketball. And I'm really proud of his commitment to kids, and I can't say enough about, you know, how excited I am about his leadership. I don't know him well, but I just have an instinctively good feeling about his commitment and the work he's going to do.
Kevin, I did not mention earlier that you had the opportunity to serve as a member of the Education Policy Committee for President Obama during his campaign. Tell us a little bit about that experience and some of the policy initiatives that have developed out of that.
Well, I don't know the president well. I know him a little bit, I was asked to serve on his Education Policy Committee, and when we started, there were only, I would guess, 50 of us around the country. By the end of the campaign, there must have been 300 or 400. But, you know, we'd have regular calls, and I half jokingly say that I was surprised I survived, because I was talking about charter schools and choice. And I can candidly say that the policy committee under, you know, in the Obama campaign was divided into the folks who were like me, pushing for reform, and then the folks who were the status quo folks, you know, the union influence and the like. Now, I was to the far end of the reform people, so, I think that the status quo folks largely ran the committee. But the good news is that we ended up, those of us pushing for reform, we ended up getting the person we wanted in as the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan. The folks who were pushing, you know, more of a status quo agenda, they had another candidate. So, you know, we won that. And then, the ultimate policy, you know, with the race to the top in the innovation grants, the performance pay, which, you know, candidate Obama didn't back away from. I mean, you know, honestly, you know, I think that every time we had an internal debate, you know, the candidate Obama always sided with the reformers, and that left me with high hopes, and I think that Secretary Duncan has continued along that path. And Tony Bennett even said, when we talked about it, he said, hey, you know, you can't argue with the reform initiative coming from the Secretary of Education and the administration. I mean, I think that's really been a good thing. And again, I want them to go even further, but you know, for what we're used to seeing out of a Democratic administration, this is really, really exciting what's going on there.
Kevin, any concerns regarding federal control versus state and local control? What's the proper mix, the proper balance, and does some of the current discussion, does it, with more dollars coming from Washington, does that tip the hand too far in one direction or not?
I tell you, Tom, that's an excellent question. I mean, I'm very concerned about Big Brother, and I'm very concerned about the federal government trying to assert itself too much. And it's a balancing act. I will say this, though, that this is one area in education, since we're talking about new dollars, that as long as the dollars are held out there to drive reform, I think it's a good thing. The worst thing that could happen is if we allow those dollars just to go into closed state education budget gaps, so you can keep the people on the payroll and you don't have any change. And there are some states, there are members of Congress, you know, who stood, you know, in the chambers and said, no, you know, the president needs to take off some of these restrictions, and we need these dollars to close our gaps so we don't have to lay off teachers and blah, blah, blah. And I just don't agree with that. I mean, I think that if we're going to use these dollars, from the federal government, then the criteria of change is a good thing. And because the bottom line is, as the President and Secretary Duncan said, you don't have to take the dollars. So if you don't want the dollars, then fine. But if you're going to take them, then you've got to buy into an agenda for change that benefits kids. And so I think that's a real good thing. But we always should be wary of the federal government, playing too big a role in the states. And I've become more passionate about that issue over time, because you want to make sure that the states continue to have their independence over their own policy initiatives for their folks.
Kevin, how do you categorize what needs to happen in the American education system? I'll give you two choices, and you can pick one or a hybrid of them. But are we in a situation where we can reform, or where we can make incremental changes to allow achievement and performance to rise? Or is it a situation where we're really looking at a flawed system that requires a much more comprehensive overhaul?
I'm not sure, Tom. That's an excellent question. I think that incremental change of the system may be warranted in some places, but I'm very, very wary of the long range reform plan. I talk about this in my speeches, and I talked about it at the Economic Club. I get nervous when I hear people talk about, give us 3 to 5 years and we'll fix things. Well, we know that 3 to 5 year reform plan that most superintendents put in place usually doesn't happen. And then we have this dumbing down mediocrity thing going on where, after 3 to 5 years, if we've improved it by 2 or 3 percentage points, then we tend to pat ourselves on the back. I have a more radical view. I think that we need to be completely open to major change, major innovation, major wholesale system-wide change. I'm willing to embrace almost anything that we know will move the yardstick further to benefit children. So I think that – so I look at it in two ways. The long and short of it is that, yes, we've got to fix the system in these school districts around the country, and that will take time. And we need folks like the Tony Bennett, the Michelle Reeves, the Joel Kleins, the Alfonso Alonso in Baltimore. You need those folks in those superintendent slots to help push for change. But by the same token, you need to have, innovative choice options for parents today to help with those kids in the most dire educational circumstances now. That's why I like scholarships or vouchers. That's why charter schools are important. That's why virtual schools are important. That's why tax credits, so you can target them to kids in failing schools so they can go to good schools. I think that when you have a mixture of those options available, I tell you, it really helps push the system toward change, because they start to realize that their own survival is being dictated by whether or not they offer a good work product for these families, a good education product. So, I think, the radicalness of some of these proposals really helps accelerate this 3 to 5 year plan that people talk about more than what is given credit for. And we've seen it in D.C. I don't know if that answers your question, but I tend to think that if just the focus on the long-term system change alone, it just won't do it. It just won't. I mean, you've got to do something for these kids and these families that are in dire straits today and give them something that they otherwise wouldn't have.
Well, Kevin, certainly one of the ways that you and others have done that in Washington is through the Opportunity Scholarship Program. Tell our listeners a little bit about that, and unfortunately, how I guess that's in a little bit of jeopardy at this point.
Well, you know, I talked about the good things that the President and Secretary Duncan are doing in education. Well, this is an area where I fought them, and I fought them publicly, and I will continue to fight them. The Opportunity Scholarship Program was put in place back in 2003 when I was chair of the Education Committee on the D.C. Council, and Mayor Williams, who was our mayor at the time, we came together, worked with Secretary Rod Paige, Education Secretary Rod Paige, and President Bush, for a three-sector strategy to help D.C. schools. Because of D.C.'s unique relationship with the federal government, the three-sector strategy that we proposed would be that the federal government would have a first-of-its-kind $50 million program where a third of the money would go to D.C. charter schools for innovative change, a third of the money to D.C. public schools, and a third of the money for a voucher program or a scholarship program, where nearly 2,000 kids would get $7,500 vouchers to go to private schools of their choice. And the great thing about the program is for those schools that participated, $7,500 wouldn't cover some of the more expensive schools like Sidwell Friends, where the president's kids go, or St. Albans. But those schools agreed that they would scholarship the rest. So if their tuition was $15,000, they would get the $7,500, and then they scholarship the rest of the kids. The program has now been in existence 6 years, and it's been amazingly successful. In fact, one of our scholarship recipients was valedictorian at Carroll Catholic School, Archbishop Carroll Catholic School in D.C., one of our highly regarded, you know, Catholic high schools, and one of our scholarship kids was valedictorian last year. And these kids, and the valedictorian even said that if it wasn't for the scholarship program, she would have never even made it to college because she was going to a failing school. So the program's worked well. It's been the most studied program ever by the Department of Education. Demonstrable gains in reading. The trend lines are good across the board. And the union hates the program because it's a voucher program. And when President Obama was elected and then Secretary Duncan came in, within, you know, a few weeks, they said they were going to end the program and shut it down immediately. Well, I think hindsight is 20/20. I think they even admit they jumped too quickly, but I think that was something they put out there for the union since they were pushing on these other Race to the Top and innovation grant things. And so those of us who, you know, support the program, we began an aggressive campaign. We had rallies where we had thousands of parents and families and D.C. residents come. We had, you know, 15,000 D.C. residents sign petitions. A majority of the council, the mayor, the superintendent all support the program. We did polling where 75% of D.C. residents support the program. We ran TV ads against the president on this program, local TV ads in D.C. And, you know, the bottom line is they still haven't come around to save the program, but we're hopeful that we can turn this around because it benefits kids. And I think, as I've said to Secretary Duncan, and I've said publicly in some of my statements to the president, that it, you know, we can't talk about system-wide change if we're not educating each child. And for us to take these kids, because when they decided to end the program, 216 kids had gotten letters of acceptance, and they were excited, and then they got it taken away. And those kids that were going to go to good private schools now go to schools where the average failure rate is 80%. So we've now just doomed these kids to go to failing schools, and some of them unfortunately may fail themselves as a result. So my view is that it's real important for us to be intellectually honest about this, and, you know, it's just not right. And I think that this Opportunity Scholarship Program has worked, and the only reason why they ended the program or trying to end the program is because of the politics. And I think that's just a tragedy, and it is a microcosm of the problem we face all over the country where, you know, the good reform programs that work for kids often get gobbled up by the politics, and we just have to have that kind of approach stop.
Kevin, I was fascinated by something you said near the end of your Economic Club presentation, and fascinated not so much by the complexity, but kind of the common sense approach that you take of whether or not you support an education proposal that you hear about. Can you share that with the audience today?
Yeah, it's funny because when I would talk to people, about educators, about, you know, some of these things, particularly when we started the charter school movement in D.C., when we talked about our voucher program, they would talk about, oh, well, you know, the Republicans are pushing this. So they talk about, oh, well, you know, I worked in the system all these years, and, you know, this is the way we've always done it. So they talk about all these things, and very rarely did I hear people talk about the people who were saying no to change about kids. And so the approach I've taken, and I've said this to legislators, fellow legislators around the country, and whenever people try to back me in a corner about my views, my simple yardstick is this. Will this proposal help a child or group of children learn? And if the answer is yes, then I'm for it. If the answer is no, I'm against it. And it is just that simple. So our Opportunity Scholarship Program, if those 216 kids will be able to go to private schools that are great schools, and some of those kids would be going to school with the president's kids. Okay, so they're going to learn in that environment as opposed to going to a school where 80% of the kids are failing. How can I be against it under that proposal? And I do think that for those of us who are promoting policy and good policy, education policy in this country, that really needs to be the yardstick. Will this help a child learn? Yes or no? And if it will help a child learn, you know, forget the politics. Let's have the courage to push it because that's what's best for the country. And unless and until we get to that point of view, I think we're going to have problems, because if there's a way to compromise on whether or not we support something that helps kids learn, then shame on us. And I think it is that stark and that clear.
Very, very well said. Kevin, to the people listening today, the citizens of Indianapolis, central Indiana, people you encounter in your work as you travel around the country, who are asking, well, what can I do? How can I make a difference? What do you tell those people?
Well, the first thing I say is you need to be educated about education, and that's not always easy. But I can tell you that the challenge with education reform is so personal that usually when your kids make it through, you take a sigh of relief and you're done with it. And I think that this is such an American priority issue that we all need to be involved. So we need to be engaged about what's happening and understand that we can't just rely on school board members or our leaders. And then pay attention more about some of this stuff. And there's countless stuff in the paper and on the internet about education reform and about parental choice and about performance pay and race to the top. And I think you just take the time to look at that. Secondly, you need to get involved. And I think that the best way to get involved for those of you who are, you know, support local candidates is ask them questions. I'm always struck by the fact that, you know, most politicians who run for office, and I'm a recovering politician, so I can say this, but most of them just give sort of non-specific answers to education questions. They say, oh, well, you know, I support more money for schools, or we're going to help teachers. But, you know, you got to dig deeper. You got to ask them, you know, do you support a work rule that will let a bad teacher stay in a classroom? Yes or no? I mean, what would you do to change that? Would you support a good charter school even though other people don't want it because they feel it's a threat to the status quo? I mean, you need to dig a little deeper, and I think that the way to do that is to ask specific questions of legislators. I think that we have to, you know, the average citizen can also be involved in helping with their neighborhood school, because there are a lot of good public schools, traditional public schools, that, you know, could be even better if the bureaucracy didn't get in the way. And I think that when you see that, you know, some of those challenges, Tony Bennett and I talked a little bit about that, you know, it's not like all public schools are bad schools. There are some great public schools out there that would be even greater if they didn't have to do that bureaucracy. If the principal didn't have to requisition downtown to get a blackboard that takes 6 weeks to get. You know, so, you know, I think that people who do have kids in great schools need to keep pushing the system to take the bureaucracy out of education. And then finally, I just think that we need to make sure that people understand that this is really a priority. I mean, it's been pushed on the back burner for so long that we can't afford to have it in that place anymore. When we talk about our competitiveness around the world, we talk about our competitiveness as a democracy. You know, we can't have half of our kids drop out of school and be competitive. And so I think there's so much that people can be done, but you need to be educated about education. You need to get involved. You need to focus in on your local school. You need to do what you can to challenge those who are the policymakers and elected officials so that they give this the attention it deserves. And, you know, let's just be honest. I mean, I think that the thing that I try to do more than anything is to not sugarcoat it. It upsets some people, but I tell you what, you know, it has people thinking because that's the only way we can get this thing done right.
Well, Kevin, the passion you bring is obvious, obviously, in the presentations I've seen, and I think our listeners heard it today. My final point, I guess, is there a way that people can contact you, either a website or an email, if they want some additional information, any of the organizations you're involved with?
Sure. The best way to reach me is kpchavous, C-H-A-V-O-U-S, at AOL.com. And then I have my own website at kevinpchavous.com, www.kevinpchavous.com. But my AOL email address is the best way. And you know what? I try to respond to all my emails, and I love the great state of Indiana. Let's just make sure we educate our kids.
Kevin, thank you so much for the time today and for all your work in this area. We really appreciate it. Thank you, and have a great rest of the day.
Thank you, Tom. God bless, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to today's Economic Club of Indiana presentation. Our guest was Kevin Chavous, an Indiana native and a national education reform advocate who is on a mission to provide each and every child equal access to a high-quality education. Education remains the topic for the next Economic Club presentation. Tom Snyder, Ivy Tech Community College president, will speak at the monthly luncheon on February 23rd at the Indiana Convention Center. Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.